Happy 5th Israeli Election Day. This morning, I participated in a conversation on the Commentary podcast with John Podhoretz, Noah Rothman, Abe Greenwald, and Christine Rosen, where we dissected these Israeli elections and really went through the different scenarios for the formation of a new Israeli government. So it's a good crash course on all the different permutations we can expect as the Israeli elected leaders head into negotiations after the election for the formation of a new government. And we even explore a scenario where there is a 6th Israeli election next spring. At the end of our conversation, we also have a quick debrief on the latest state of play in the U.S. congressional and gubernatorial midterm elections. So stick around for that as well. This is Call Me Back.
Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is Tuesday, November 1st, 2022. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. With me, as always, executive editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Media commentary columnist and American Enterprise Institute fellow Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Associate editor and author of Rise of the New Puritans, Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And joining us today, my old friend, Commentary Inc. board member, author of Startup Nation, expert on all things Israeli and American political, Dan Senor. Hi, Dan.
Good morning, John. How are you?
I'm good. So we are here this morning with you in part because Israel is going, is right now, Israelis, as we speak, are voting in the, is it the fifth or the sixth
fifth.
Election?
Fifth, it's
the
fifth election in 44 months.
Okay, so it's more than, I'm being very unfair.
You
That's
are.
That's actually 3.5 years. I was shorting them.
I would say, John, I was in Tel Aviv last week and I was on a panel with Tom Nides, who's the U.S. ambassador to Israel. And he was pointing out how much more simple his life would be if he were ambassador to the U.K. instead of ambassador to Israel, trying to manage all this crazy politics. And I pointed out to him that since 2015, the U.K. has had 5 prime ministers. Israel's only had 3. Yeah, it could be much worse in the sweepstakes for, you know, broken electoral systems.
Right. Okay. So we thought we would try to provide you, as you're going to hear a lot in the news, and there's a lot of apocalyptic talk about this election in particular. Not that that's so surprising, because there's always a lot of apocalyptic talk among disappointed liberals, particularly Jewish liberals, about the direction of Israeli politics. In general, with the strength of kind of deciding strength factor of Haredi and other ultra-Orthodox Jews and settlers and people that they tend not to like. So here's where we are. We have 5 scenarios, I think we came up with last night, 5 scenarios to offer you to explain what is going on in the Israeli elections. But first, before we do the 5 scenarios, we need to just lay out a few factors for people who don't know that much about Israeli politics. So the Israeli politics is decided. There is no general election for the leader of the country, as is true in most. There was briefly a moment when you could vote for the prime minister, but that moment came and went and the law was changed. So you vote for party, and the Knesset, the parliament, has 120 seats. So whoever controls 61 seats is the prime minister. Whichever party dominates in the coalition that runs up to 61 seats ends up controlling the prime ministership.
It's a proportional system. So unlike parliamentary systems, say in the UK or Canada, which members of parliament have individual constituencies or ridings that they represent, in Israel, it's a single district, the whole country. So there are no individual members of the Knesset, of the parliament, that represent specific regions of the country. So all that's done, it's which parties get which seats or how many seats is determined by the proportion of the vote. So just for simplicity's sake, if your party gets 10% of the overall national vote, your party gets 12 seats in the Knesset. It's actually that simple, one would think. The problem is, and we're going to get into this because this is what really is creating a lot of confusion with this election, is one would say, okay, well, that's simple, right? 10%. If you get 10, if your party gets 10% of the vote, you get 12 seats. And if you get 1% of the vote, then you get 1.2, so call it one seat. So, and there are something like 39 or 40 parties running in this election. Now, only 10 to 12 of them will actually wind up in government, but there are all these other parties, and all these other parties, if all they have to do is get 1% of the vote. If they just get 1% of the vote, they get a seat. And in fact, with that one seat, enough of them could become kingmakers as coalitions are formed. But there is a law that has a threshold mandate, which is, yes, it's proportional, but your party has to get a minimum of 3.25% of the vote in order for you to get represented in parliament, which is about in the Knesset, which is about four seats. So if you're competitive enough to get, say, in that range, but you don't get 3.25%, not only do your votes disappear, but even your sort of ideological allies don't get to benefit from them. So you have a bunch of parties running now that both blocks need, the BB-led bloc and the anti-BB-led bloc. There are a bunch of small parties that each of them need. And what is coming up in a lot of the polling is a number of these parties are dangerously close to falling behind that threshold, which means you could have tens of thousands of votes be totally wasted.
So here's, this system is so crazy that this government that fell and is now supposedly going to be replaced in the current election. The person who at first ended up becoming the prime minister, excuse me, this is not this government. Anyway,
it is this government. It's just there was a rotation
relationship.
Yeah, right. There was a rotation. Right.
It is this government. It is the same government. Right. And Bennett, even though he's no longer prime minister, his party is still a member of the government.
Okay, so the first prime minister in this rotation was Naftali Bennett. And Naftali Bennett was a member of Bibi's party, Likud, and in fact, a deputy to Bibi, began his political career as a deputy.
Yeah, he was chief of staff to Bibi when he was in the opposition, ran his office.
Yeah, and like everybody who gets close to Bibi, you know, now hates him like poison.
Except Ron Dermer,
that's right. Bennett ends up, because of the incredibly complex system that Dan sort of laid out, in which votes to sit on all this, ended up becoming prime minister of the country when his party scored a total of seven seats. And the reason this is interesting is that Bibi Netanyahu's Likud party, which is the got 30 seats, I believe, in that election. He's by far and away the most popular politician in Israel, and Likud is maybe not far and away, but is the most popular party in the country. And for the past all of those elections, Bibi could not take his party and then assemble a coalition that got to 61 seats. And then there was an election after election after election. And then this not Bibi coalition made up of Bennett, former military man named Benny Gantz, and then a kind of telegenic TV personality moderate named Yair Lapid, who is now the prime minister, sort of came
and some defectors from Bibi's Likud. Like Gideon Star, who was in previous Likud governments under Bibi, he founded a new party. Right. Obviously, Ayelet Shaked had her own party. She's on the right. Right. So
Ayelet Shaked's party is one of the parties that is.
Yeah, she's interior minister now.
She is, but she is not. All the polling suggests her party will not make the 3.25% threshold, and it's possible that Bennett's party.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Bennett's party's gone.
The former prime minister, it's gone. Yeah.
So I think Bennett's party's gone.
The guy who 2 years ago a year ago, became the prime minister. His party cannot get 3.25% of the vote in the country.
Yeah, and Gideon Saar, who was a Likud member in Bibi's government, who formed his own party and had his own power center, is in the current government, is worried about not meeting the threshold. So he merged with Benny Gantz, the current defense minister, to kind of create a bigger block. So there are these wild card situations, right?
Okay, so let's get into the scenarios.
Yeah.
Because again, Bibi, most popular politician in the country. The polling shows that Likud will get the most seats, as it has gotten in every single one of these elections. Likud gets the most seats, but it's dropped from its high watermark, I don't know, 8 years ago, of 35 or 36 seats down to 30.
Yeah.
And Bibi kept assembling coalitions that would get to 59 seats or 60 seats, and he just couldn't get that last seat to get to 61 and be in these elections. So nothing has changed, even though Bibi's under indictment and everything like that. All the polling suggests he's around 30 seats, and Lapid's party, Lapid being the sitting prime minister, is polling at around 25, 26 seats.
So, like, for purpose of the discussion, let's just call Lapid the head of the anti-Bibi bloc. So Bibi's head of the Bibi bloc, and Lapid is the head of the anti-Bibi bloc.
Right. So all the election analysts say that at this moment, based on polling, although it's also weird because you can't, Israeli law forbids polling in the last week, or is it?
Is fantastic. Poll can be published 3 days before the election under Israeli law, which means every news organization polls like crazy right up until, in this case, Friday. So on Friday night, just before Shabbat, you had 15 polls published. 15 polls, like reputable polls published. So if you think of, and in Israel, like the Shabbat dinner is like our Thanksgiving, like all these families get together every Friday night, multiple three generations. It's like 70%+ of the country does some kind of multi-generational family gathering every Friday night. So just imagine how crazy political discussions get around our Thanksgiving table. Now imagine Friday night, all these families are still assembling a few days before the election with 15 polls just published. They all read it on their phones, then shut down their phones, and they're loaded for bear to, like, you know, get into brutal arguments over their over their Friday night dinner. It's fantastic. So
we don't have an up to the minute picture.
Right.
And so,
I mean, all the Likud, all the, you know, the polling has the Netanyahu-led bloc at like anywhere from 59 to 62, 63 seats. That's kind of the range. If you look at
so, of course, they need 61 to be back in power. But there are all these scenarios that show them just at 60 or at 59 or something like that. So now we should run through what might happen in the next 6 weeks, with the proviso that if no government is formed in the next 6 weeks, guess what happens?
Election number six. Can I just say, it's incredible to see the turnout in these frequent elections. It's quite high, correct?
It's high.
I mean,
exactly.
How they don't have election fatigue. It's actually it's something to aspire to as Americans.
It's a national holiday, Election Day. So people are, but you're right. I mean, voting is not compulsory. So the fact that they get this turnout is extraordinary. Although certain communities are going to see lower turnout than usual, because I think some of them are burnt out.
But I think there were one of these many elections where there was election fatigue, and there was a lot of crying and wailing about election fatigue and Israelis can't take it anymore and all this. And I think what happened is the turnout fell to like 77%. That's election fatigue in Israel, is like turnout that's just around 80, just around 8 out of 10 voters actually turns out. Okay, so the scenario. So remember, Bibi Netanyahu, the head of the Likud party, was prime minister was the longest serving prime minister in Israel's, continuously serving prime minister in Israel's history. Also the longest serving prime minister in history, discontinuously, because he had a 2-year term in the 1990s. Is currently in an incredibly long trial. It's going to take another year just to continue hearing the witnesses. Three charges, corruption charges against him, which are, by the way, nonsense, but we won't go into that. It's a preposterous political moment that he's even having to face the legal system with these three cases against him. Nonetheless, he is the sole issue in the campaign, meaning are there disagreements about how to handle Iran? Not really.
No.
Does anybody not like the Abraham Accords? Not really.
Is there much disagreement on what to do about the Palestinian Authority or the Hamas and the Gaza? Very little. You saw Lapid take, you know, military action against Hamas and Gaza in August, and Netanyahu was very supportive. I mean, talks about the polarization of Israeli politics, and that's the perception over here and what kind of shapes the press coverage of Israeli politics. The reality is it's not that polarized. I mean, ideologically, it's all people have very strong views about Bibi on one side or the other. But on the actual issues, there's actually a pretty broad consensus.
And, you know, there is now a serious and interesting, complicated policy dispute involving a deal struck with Lebanon over oil fields in the Mediterranean. And it's interesting and it's complicated. And I think on balance, Dan and I and a lot of people who think the way people on this podcast think don't think it's a very good deal, and that Lapid was too eager for a win and agreed to this so that he could rack something up and have a good moment with the Americans and look like he had made a major foreign policy move. But it's still a policy. It's still, despite efforts and things you may read about how this is catastrophic and it's disastrous and, you know, Israel is doing something absolutely, you know, horrible. It just isn't like it is.
And there are many on the right who basically think Netanyahu's been critical of Lapid, and I think there's plenty to be critical about, but there are also, you know, plenty on the right who think that if Netanyahu were prime minister, he probably would have cut
the same deal or something.
Similar. Yeah.
So anyway, the point is that there isn't a lot, the policy, whereas until really the mid-2000s, I mean, the political situation of the Middle East has changed so radically that until the middle 2000s, there were deep, profound disagreements about existential matters of policy in Israeli politics, how to deal with the Palestinian Authority, how to deal with Gaza, how to deal with militarization of the Palestinians, how to deal with Lebanon, the northern border, how to deal with the United States. There was a lot of stuff. And really, in the last 10 years, things have changed so much that those central existential issues have kind of fallen by the wayside. And so you really are talking about Bibi versus not Bibi. And Bibi is an incredibly controversial figure because on the one hand, he is inarguably the most successful Democratic leader of the last, pretty much of the 21st century in terms of his ability to help his country progress in ways that are really staggering, both diplomatically and economically and in all kinds of ways. And on the other hand, he's very untrustworthy. He mistreats people. He behaves very high-handedly, and as I said, everybody around him ends up somehow becoming his enemy. He cannot keep people around him because he is disloyal to them, but expects total loyalty from them. So he is the hinge figure here. Okay, five scenarios. So let's start with scenario number one, which is Bibi forms a government. He goes into coalition, or we'll take two scenarios. Bibi goes into government. There are two scenarios in which he forms a coalition that helps him return to the prime minister's office. So, Dan, coalition number one.
Coalition number one is Bibi. The Bibi-led bloc wins an outright majority, 61 plus seats. That consists of Likud, his party. It consists of the two ultra-Orthodox party, the Shas party and the United Torah Judaism party, which have you know, more often than not stuck with him. And then the new kind of big story of this election is this National Religious Party, led by two very provocative figures, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smoltrich, these two individuals who are, you know, they're hardcore. The most generous description of them is they're hardcore, pretty extreme right wing leaders. The less generous description of them is they're like Mayor Kahanist figures who are advocating positions that no one in mainstream Israeli politics has advocated for. Total annexation of the West Bank. Ben-Gvir himself is like, he's defined himself by stirring up trouble at the Temple Mount, which is always a flashpoint between Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews on the anniversary of Israel's unification of Jerusalem. That's often when you see, I'm not saying he's directly responsible, but he definitely stirs things up. He's famous or infamous for when he was much younger, he says he's took it down, but you know, 25, 27 years ago, there was that horrendous tragedy where a deranged settler, Baruch Goldstein, was in the West Bank and slaughtered 25 or 30 Palestinians. It was like a mass casualty attack. He was infamous, Ben-Gvir, for having a picture of Baruch Goldstein hanging in his home or his office. I mean, he kind of lionizing Baruch Goldstein. I mean, this is the kind of politics that he's trafficked in, and he's always been kind of a bit player, and he's no longer a bit player, so it seems. Not only is he not a bit player, but he and his partner, who he's merged parties with, Smoltrich, they may be key to the scenario that you just described, John, which is Netanyahu getting to 61 plus seats and being able to form a government, because Netanyahu was clever in getting them to merge their parties. So going back to what I said earlier about parties not falling below the mandate, he was concerned that one of them could fall below the mandate and lose a lot of right-leaning votes. So he got them to merge. So they basically capture, they don't lose any votes. That's the reason to do these mergers. They happen on both sides, or historically have happened on both sides. And two, he's basically, you know, locked arms with them. I mean, he doesn't really appear with them, but he's conveyed that Ben-Gvir will serve in his government. Ben-Gvir will be a minister. He said that as recently as the last couple of days. Keep in mind, a year ago, Netanyahu said Ben-Gvir was unfit to be a minister in government. So he's totally built these guys up, and they are polling, you know, very competitively. They could get, you know, well north of 10 seats, which would put them in a very powerful position in a right of center government. And where their votes are coming from is that's the tricky part. Like no one they could be taking votes from the ultra-Orthodox parties, and the ultra-Orthodox parties are worried about that. There's a sense that among particularly some of the younger ultra-Orthodox male voters, they've become much more nationalist, and Ben-Gvir's kind of charisma and provocations is like attractive to them. They could potentially be taking votes from those two right-wing parties that you and I, John, talked about earlier, which is Yamina Bennett's party and the New Hope party, which is the Gideon, former Likud Gideon Sar party. They could be taking votes from a Yelich Shaked small party, which probably won't make the mandate. So that could be where some of their strength is coming from. And then the other big question that analysts in Israel are asking is sort of like what we've dealt with in our politics here in the U.S. Is Ben-Gvir going to just pull out a bunch of voters that we just haven't seen before? Is it a feature, not a bug?
Trump in Wisconsin. Yeah.
Trump in Wisconsin, that suddenly he's appealing to people that pollsters aren't capturing. And this sort of national religious charisma, very right wing nationalist religious charisma, is appealing to voters who may have historically sat in that small minority that actually didn't turn out to elections, and now they're turning out. And could that be enough to buy them another couple seats? So that's
right. There one interesting wrinkle here is that Israeli politics, religious parties have been hinge figures and coalitions forever. These guys are different because most religious parties get into government with the idea of getting governmental spoils and money for their people, They want to control the education ministry so that they can get money for, you know, through their school.
Yeah, system. Subsidies for the communities.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And they want right. some guarantees on not weakening the role of Jewish law in the state.
Right.
But no public transportation on the Sabbath. Yeah. You know, we can go on and on. Yeah. Yeah.
But they are very transactional. I mean, so transactional that it is routine for politicians from Israeli religious parties to go to jail or to get arrested, you know, or I mean, they're hyper Machiavelli, like realistic. They want things from government. That's why they're in power, and they want to maintain certain privileges that religious people have. These guys are different. They are ideologically driven in a way that is probably more familiar to American voters at the national level than the kind of politics I'm talking about from other religious parties. And because the religious parties have a history of corruption, and Ben Gvir and Smotrich are different kinds of figures, that's also where they might get votes from religious voters who are disappointed in the parties for which they have voted, because they think that the people who run them are crooks.
Yeah, and I mean, what's amazing, there was an ad I saw when I was in Israel. So the Shas party, which is one of these ultra-Orthodox parties, they are running an ad. I've never seen this before, where they have a young ultra-Orthodox male going into the voting booth to vote, and he's actually choosing between a Shas party, you know, checking off the Shas party, checking off Likud, and checking off the religious Zionist party, the Smotrich Ben Gvir photo. And he's like deciding between the three. And then they beam in footage from the deceased founder of the Shas movement, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, who is like, they just use past clips of him. But like the way they edit it, it's like him admonishing this young, you know, lost ultra-Orthodox Shas voter, or would be Shas voter, from even contemplating voting for another one of these parties, which tells you how worried they are. They are worried exactly about what you're describing, John, is that these young voters who have historically just done what the elders have told them to do, to go vote for United Torah Judaism and to vote for Shas, are going to start dancing with this other party.
Yosef, by the way, has been dead a decade. So just to give you an idea of how desperate they are, like they have to reach back to a dead holy man to try to get people to fall back in line. It's fascinating. Anyway, so that's scenario number one, in which Bibi goes into coalition with the national religious parties, with this national religious coalition, which is causing this is the, oh my God, this is the end of Israeli democracy. We're lining up with these racist anti-Arabs who are following in the footsteps of Meir Kahana, by the way, himself now dead 30 odd years, killed by a terrorist in a hotel on Lexington Avenue in New York City. The first, as Andy McCarthy says, the first actual act of jihad, unless you want to count Robert Kennedy's assassination, the first act of the modern jihad, Muslim terrorism in the United States was the murder of Kahana. And, you know, oh my God, this is it. This is the end of everything. And this is a big geschrei and all that. One thing I should mention before we go on is that every election season in Israel, every election has a party that comes out of nowhere and everybody goes, ooh, this could change everything. And often it's all a sugar high. And when people actually go to the polls, it doesn't happen. The last one was a kind of right-wing pot lover whose name I can't remember.
Yeah.
But who, you know, like there was
he was basically a mix of legalization of marijuana and and like super libertarian on markets, like right, for free and markets, market reform.
And but also like
wanted
to annex the West Bank or something. I mean, anyway, but there was this whole like, I met various people on the right who were like, I'm voting for him. Yeah. That's really, and there, and he scored in the polls and stuff, and then he didn't even make the threshold. So his party disappeared. But like, there is this thing. It's like every season. And that's where you have to be cautious about, you know, these.
Yeah, but I do think there's something real going on with this one. I'm not, I don't think they're just going to.
And it's generational because Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are young.
Yeah.
They're in their 40s, both of them. And they are, and they're professionals. That's the interesting thing. Like Smotrich is a lawyer who defends. Defended Israelis who get accused of beating up, Israeli hooligans who end up, accused of beating up Arabs or doing something like that. And Ben-Gvir, is he also a lawyer? Anyway, they're professionals. They're not. They don't like sit around studying Talmud all day, and they're not professional politicians either. So it's an interesting moment. Okay, so that's scenario number one. We need to speed up a little. Scenario number two, not the coalition with the religious parties.
Yeah. So there's two versions of that actually. So one is, if Gantz, he's running as kind of center right, current defense minister, overperforms. Let's say he gets, I'm picking a number here, 14 plus seats, unlikely, but not impossible. If Ayelet Shaked doesn't get wiped out because she doesn't meet the mandate, there's 4 plus seats. Suddenly, Netanyahu has options. Netanyahu can say, wait a minute, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, not sure I need you. I've got Gantz and Ayelet Shaked over here, and I can actually cobble together 61 without you. So that's one way a government is formed without the Zionist nationalist party in the coalition. And then the next scenario where a Netanyahu government is formed, it would actually not be a Netanyahu government. It would be a national unity government where no party can actually form a government, or it seems difficult. Herzog, Chaim Herzog, who's the current president of Israel, whose job
Bougie
it is.
Herzog.
Chaim Bougie Herzog. Yeah. Sorry, Chaim Herzog. Sorry, Isaac Herzog. Sorry. I'm gonna get to Bougie's father in a second. Bougie Herzog, the current president, it's his job to work with the different parties after the election to negotiate how a government is formed. And he wants a national unity government. That's what he wants. He thinks it's the healthiest for Israeli democracy. It would actually keep the extreme right out of the coalition. And he's very proud of the role he played in forming this current government, which we talked about earlier, which included many firsts for Israel, including an Arab Muslim party in the government. So national unity government would be basically a government of Netanyahu, Lapid, and Gantz in some kind of rotation. And what I was saying about Isaac Herzog, which Bougie Herzog's father, is he negotiated a national unity government with a rotation in the mid 80s between then the Likud leader Yitzhak Shamir and Shimon Peres, the labor leader. And Bougie wants to, he's very proud of his father's legacy. It was a very important moment. Israeli politics was deadlocked back then. And I think Herzog thinks it could be part of his legacy to kind of continue his father's work and avoid this very extreme right wing party having a more prominent role in Israeli politics than it already does. So that's another way Bibi could wind up back in.
Okay. So these three Bibi scenarios, religious party, coalition without the religious party, with the national religious party, and a national unity government. The last two, I think it is fair to say that in his heart of hearts, the scenario that Bibi would like best is number two. He would like to be able to go into coalition with Gantz and avoid the national religious party. This is the secret of Bibi. When you get down to it, he is a very non-ideological politician in a very ideological coalition, governing a very ideological coalition, and he would prefer not to have this pressure placed on him by the right to do things that would alienate the relationship with the United States and various other things. but it's a hard lift. And it's a hard lift for Benny Gantz, who is kind of be a little like Lucy in the football, for him to go into coalition with Bibi with promises and guarantees of things, because he knows Bibi will screw him.
He's done it before. They were together. It was supposed to be rotation. Bibi negotiated the first slot. Gantz was supposed to take over in like a year later. And lo and behold, the government fell apart 6 months in, and they went to a new election, and Gantz never got to be prime minister. So,
right.
And by the way, the stuff they're saying about each other, I mean, I know politics gets heated and people work past it once they get. I got to tell you, the last few days, Gantz and Bibi are saying about each other, the idea that these guys are going to be in a government together. I mean, I guess, you know, never say never, but wow.
Okay. And the National Unity Government has some of the same difficulties, because then you would basically have got Lapid, the current, his entire political definition is that he's not Bibi. He has no.
And that he would never serve with Bibi. He served with Bibi briefly as finance minister in 2013, 2014. But since then, he's like, his whole political persona has been in opposition to Bibi.
Right. Okay.
So let me just say one other thing here, because it's you mentioned these legal problems that Bibi has. Yeah. I mean, it's left unsaid that, you know, by Bibi and the people around him, but it's understood that, you know, he wants, by being prime minister and having his own government, somehow these legal challenges be relieved. That the sitting prime minister, you can't be prosecuting a sitting prime minister, and a sitting prime minister can't be bogged down in a trial. And so it's understood that the National Religious Party, as part of a coalition, would kind of help him achieve that. It's not clear that Lapid, or even Gantz, but let's just say Lapid, could live in a world where he formed a government that resulted in Bibi getting off the hook on the legal stuff, for all the reasons we just said, because his whole persona is so anti-Bibi. The question is, could Herzog, the president, basically say to Lapid, in the national interest, you guys all have to be in a government together. We got to keep the extremists out. And in order to do this, we've got to come up with some mechanism to take the legal pressure off Bibi. It's the only way it'll work. The threat to our country, Herzog would argue, and apparently he has said, you know, to other officials, the threat to our country is far greater. The threat of these guys, the Smoltrich and Ben-Gvir joining the government, that's the threat to the country. Seeing a successful end to the legal pressure on Bibi is not.
Okay, so and let's go to the last scenarios, which are Bibi doesn't become prime minister,
right? So those are two. So that's Lapid gets north of 60, and he just is able to form a government. It feels very unlikely, because he's already, I mean, if you add up all his all the anti-Bibi block parties, it's all winds up 55, 56 seats. So he's got a much bigger jump, his block, from like the mid 50s to 61 than Bibi has, if you believe all the polling, from 60 to 61. And the other issue, if you look at the parties that are at biggest risk of losing, falling beneath the threshold, almost all of them are on the anti-Bibi block. All right. It's Labor, it's Meretz, it's a couple of the Arab parties, it's Ram, which is the Arab Muslim party that's in the current government. I think they'll make it. It's Avigdor Lieberman's party, Yisrael Beiteinu. So these, you know, now I don't think all of them will fall behind, but if like one or two of them do, it completely screws up Lapid's calculus. So much so, this was also, I talked about that Shas TV ad, another extraordinary site. Lapid was campaigning, I think last week, in Labor and Meretz strongholds, encouraging voters to vote for Labor or Meretz. So now why? Because he worries he'd be a victim of his own success. If he convinces enough of them to vote for him, that's good news, because his net vote increases. But if it's just enough that it actually brings those parties below the threshold, but still many of those voters stick with those parties, he's screwed. So he was actually in Labor and Meretz strongholds campaigning for parties that aren't his own.
So there we are.
Okay, we haven't gotten to the last one.
We have one more.
Yeah, the last is no government is formed, and they go to elections again in the spring or summer of next year. And I actually think that's not a bad scenario for Lapid, because
He gets to be prime minister for another
year. And one thing Bibi did to great effect, with great it was very effective at was those multiple elections we've just described, which began in 2019, basically continued to now. For a big chunk of that time, Bibi, even though he's going from election to election to election, he was always the incumbent prime minister. He was the incumbent prime minister that was going into an election, but he was still on Balfour Street in the prime minister's residence, in charge of the government, dealing with national security crises, on television every day, managing the COVID pandemic, whatever, pick your crisis du jour. He was large and in charge. And it meant that all he was able to hold his coalition together because all these other parties felt like, okay, we're not winning elections with Bibi. We're not losing elections, though. And he's still in power and he controls all the patronage and resources we need access to. So we can't abandon him. He's now been a year in the opposition without that power. He's done okay. He's obviously held this coalition together. Can he hang on to it for 2 years? Like at some point, Lapid is going to be looking like the guy who's in charge. And that I think is a pretty good scenario for Lapid.
So that's the Israeli election portrait. Amazingly informative. Let's move on to the American election, which is ends a week from today. People have been voting all over the country. 23 million votes apparently have already been cast in this election. A major milestone occurred yesterday for people who are insane granular followers of politics. I've mentioned this before. The 538, the Nate Silver's website, runs this simulation of elections. It's a probability index that is called a casino in like statistics. 40,000 different scenarios are run by a computer, and then they offer in these 40,000 scenarios, Democrats prevail in the House by this many thousands of times versus Republicans, and the same in the Senate. So 3 or 4 weeks ago, if you ran the model, the 538 model, Democrats had a 69% chance of maintaining control of the Senate. And yesterday afternoon, the model hit 50-50, that Republicans and Democrats have an equal chance of winning the Senate. So the model has moved in the Republican direction by 20 points, or you know, whatever that is. That's like however many simulations that is in the thing. And so my guess is that among people who watch this stuff, you know, like hysterically, we are now moving into the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross stages of grief for Democrats, which are anger, denial, bargaining, acceptance, and I can't remember what the fifth is, even though I think that was all crap, that this is actually not what the stages of grief are. Nonetheless, using it for this purpose. Dan, you spent a lot of time talking to people behind the scenes. But we were talking last night, and I would not say that, despite what I'm saying, that Democrats have every reason to start, you know, ordering bagels for the Shiva and, you know, getting the scissors ready to cut their to slash their clothing, that Republicans are acting like they have this in the bag, or that everything is just like, oh my God, this is so great, like everything's moving our way emotionally.
Yeah, I think there are two things going on. One, in the House, there's already some bickering between different factions among House Republicans, but basically they think they're fine. The Senate, look, for all the reasons you're saying, it looks and feels like the Republicans are going to win 51 plus seats, but you just go race by race, and you're like, well, is there a scenario, even though, for all the reasons you're saying, it looks like it's baked. Is there a reason it's not baked? So let's start Pennsylvania, right? So I heard of two internal polls, one campaign and one from one of the Republican affiliated PACs that has Oz up by two, basically a 2-point race between Oz and Fetterman. Okay, that's great. Because Fetterman had been way above Oz for, in the, according to the public polling, for a while. You know, Oz is still below 50%, right? In both those polls, I think it's like 48%, 47%, 49%. And obviously the wild card is the gubernatorial race, this Mastriano. Like, what is that going to do to Oz? So Republicans, the, you know, the, in polling, you say the trend is your friend. It's not about vote share. It's about the trend, and the trend is moving in Oz's direction. So, and given the issue set, you know, that's dominating this last week, Republicans, you know, Oz should be fine. And yet, well, we're not sure what will Mastriano be a drag on Oz. So we can't totally bet on that one. And then you look at Georgia and you say, all right, look, can you imagine a Kemp? I mean, is it, it seems that this, the abortion issue has not completely destroyed Walker, and Kemp still so is overperforming Abrams, Stacey Abrams, in the gubernatorial race, that you can't imagine a world in which there are Kemp Warnock voters. So Herschel will be fine, right? And then, well, but is candidate quality really a big problem? And could you have a bunch of people voting for Kemp and then just not voting in the Senate race? They're not Kemp Warnock voters. They're just Kemp voters. And then they disappear from the rest of the ballot. And you systematically start, you know, Kelly in Arizona is, even though Masters has tightened the race, he's still, he's the one guy who's been Democrat, who's been in these battleground states, in these battleground races, who's been consistently polling above 50%. He is a strong candidate. He's been consistently voting above, polling against 50%. So, you know, maybe that's good. So you, you start. So on the one hand, you're right, John. On the other hand, Republican operatives are like going race by race, and they're like, it's not that baked. And basically, we could easily beat a 50-50 Senate and be back in Georgia for a, you know, another vote in a month. And, you know, oh, my gosh, this is stressful.
Yeah. Noah, we've been talking about this for, you know, weeks. But like the this discrepancy when you, they do this issue polling on what people are saying on issues, right? Inflation, the number one issue, by at least 10% above abortion, at least in the recent Gallup poll. So on a, if you ask people the most important issue, they say inflation, like 49%, something like that. And then you ask them who would be better to handle it, Republicans or Democrats. Republicans are 30 points up on an issue that half the electorate says is the most important. And yet the generic ballot, do you prefer a Republican or a Democrat, is basically at 50-50. I don't understand how this computes. I continue to find this incredibly puzzling.
I find it puzzling to a certain degree. I think the electorate generally isn't sold on Republicans. It's very apprehensive about Republicans. Only 2 years ago, 4 years ago, that they voted them out of Congress and voted them out of the White House 2 years ago. But at the same time, I, at the risk of contradicting Dan, this cake is as baked as it gets. The movement in the polls in the last 2 months, or 2 weeks rather, has been pronounced. It's exactly what you would expect to see in a wave year where undecided voters are breaking in one direction and one direction only. Nate Cohen over at New York Times has this little nugget. In our final wave of Senate and House polls the last few days, a hallmark of non-response bias looks like it's backed. It's back. The non-response bias being among Republicans. Overall, white registered Democrats were 28% likelier to respond to our Senate polls than Republicans, a disparity that exceeds that from our polling in 2020, when Republicans gained, what, 13, 14 seats unexpectedly. I fully expect to see an R plus five environment, could be R plus five, six, could be R plus seven, but I expect an R plus five environment. And then the, both chambers fall. Maybe they get one seat margin, maybe they get two, three seat margin. And yes, intellectually, as I said before, it's hard to square ticket splitting to the degree that you would need to see it in places like Pennsylvania, where the top of the ticket is a huge drag. But it's really only Pennsylvania. Kerry Lake's not a drag. Kemp's going to drag Walker over the finish line. He may even get him over the 50% threshold. I would not be surprised to see it. Yeah, I think we're going to see a pretty substantial wave race.
By the way, just know I'm projecting to you the agita I'm hearing.
I get it.
I actually think Republicans are going to win the Senate and win the House well into the 230s.
I admit that I'm relying on what is disparagingly called among the kids vibes. But the vibes are pretty strong. the vibes are all moving in one direction. Yeah. And yes, I look at the same data, not the internal polling, obviously, but the public polling. And the public polling presents something of a mixed picture, but the picture is becoming clearer and clearer by the hour.
Listen, the numbers, that because it's sort of been assumed that Republicans would take the House, but because Democrats in the generic balloting were doing better than they than the atmosphere said that they should, people haven't been focusing on the wave possibilities in the House and what they mean. We are looking at a possibility of Republicans winning 25 to 30 seats. That would get them into the largest majority that Republicans have held in the House, I think, since 1946. And 1946 was itself an anomalous election because it was the first election after World War II and Roosevelt's death, and you know, the and Truman, you know, we were like
strikes
in a recession. Oh,
it was
a, strikes.
Yeah, it was absolutely terrible. Chaos.
Right. And there was a huge Republican wave in 1946. That's all, you know, what is that? That's 75, 76 years ago. We could be looking at Republicans with over 240 seats in the House.
An R plus seven environment would be about 260, which is gigantic. And
yeah, I mean, here's I don't more... even know that that's possible, yeah, because that would really mean like corpses would be beating Democrats in some, like, I don't even know if there are enough competitive races.
Here's more bias.
That's the problem, is that not the problem, but Republicans won a lot of races that no one expected them to win in 2020 because no one expected Republicans to win seats that they shouldn't win when Trump was losing. This is what Rove, you know, Rove made this point on my podcast, and others have made it. So we almost, you almost have to view 2020 and 2022 as a combo, right? Like, you know, anyways, because a lot of those 2020 wins would have happened in 2022. Right.
Nonetheless, you know, the most friendly tracker for Democrats has been the CBS YouGov tracker. And they're at, I think, seven, they're at a minimum of a 17 seat gain for Republicans, which itself brings them to the same level that they were at in after 1994. Now, 1994, you know, they won 52 seats and they had this, you know, huge wave and then took control. But again, the margin of control, if you need 218 to control the House, having 232 isn't that big a margin.
I want to bring Aiden and Christine into this because there's more vibes here. Yeah. Just because this, just to, if you read the lay of the land, you can get a sense of this panic. Kathy Hochul, governor of New York, who's in a little bit of trouble, surprisingly, governor of New York. Nevertheless, she's facing a tough election. She appears yesterday, or 2 days ago, rather, on MSNBC with Al Sharpton, where she is talking about crime. And she says that Republicans are essentially making up the crime issue. Quote, these are master manipulators. They have this conspiracy going all across America to convince people the Democratic states are not safe. Well, guess what? They're not only election deniers, they're data deniers. She's saying it doesn't exist. First of all, just take the message out of the way. Think of the venue. She's on MSNBC talking to Al Sharpton. How many registered Democrats are watching that show? How many of them are in New York? How many of them are unenthused to vote? Who on earth are you trying to talk to here? Why would you even take this message, this as insane as this message is, to this particular venue, unless you are just underwater, scrambling, drowning, and terrified?
Well, she is. She's been drowning, I mean, at least since the night of the debate. I mean, where she turned in this terrible performance and could never satisfactorily answer the crime issue.
I'm so sorry. I've just got pent up issues here. But we talk about this conspiracy theories, like Republicans are only beholden to conspiracy theories. This is a conspiracy theory. She's peddling a conspiracy theory.
It's not the last one. It's funny when John was talking about the stages of grief for Democrats. There's only going to be anger and denial here. Right. You could forget the rest. There's not going to be bargaining and acceptance. And then we're going to first see Democratic conspiracy theories.
The Hochul thing is particularly crazy because she and Mayor Adams made a major move last week. If you ride the New York City subways, there are cops flooding the platforms
Well, he was picking up garbage in the subway the other day, right?
1,800 cops are now on subway platforms 24 hours a day. And she's not going on TV to say, help is on the way. We have sent in the cavalry. Like, she's also saying, no, it's safe here.
She's not speaking to those. It's the white suburban women right now who she should be talking to. They're worried about the economy and they are worried about crime. I don't know, call them the Karen voter if you don't like them, but she is not speaking to them. And neither are a lot of these other Democrats in other states where crime and inflation are really top of mind for voters.
See, the crime issue has come into focus in a very bad way for her, for Democrats in New York, which is that it has really come to center on transit crime. It has come to center on the subway. And this is something that is so eminently relatable for New Yorkers. And it is so identifiable and everyone has seen it. And there is simply no way to talk about it. Because when you walk around the streets, you may not encounter that many scenarios.
Well,
where you
if you live in Syosset, Long Island, or you live in Purchase, New York, there's not a lot of street crime. First of all, you're not on the streets that much. And second of all, that's not where it is. The important thing about subway crime, the important thing about New York City crime is that there is a threshold that any Republican candidate, in this case, Lee Zeldin, needs to meet statewide in order to be competitive. Because it is assumed that Republicans will prevail upstate or outside of New York City, which is about half the population of the state, Democrats need to rack up huge numbers in the city and have been, in election after election, so that the minimum that a Republican needs to get simply to even be in the conversation is 30%. And there's been very little polling in New York State. We should talk about that a little bit, but there's very little polling. The last poll, Quinnipiac, had Zeldin at 37 in the city. If he gets to 37 or 40 and that solidifies, he probably wins. He's going to win Suffolk County, which is, I think, the largest. Well, Nassau is the larger county, but I mean, he might win Nassau.
I think he will win Nassau.
And I was in upstate over the weekend. I think, did I mention this yesterday? Yeah. I was in upstate yesterday. Me, yeah. Right. I did. And there was no street. Hochul had no presence.
John's become the lawn sign.
Yeah. He's which is lawn always sign bad. Tracker. It's always He's, bad. Those,
it's happened to the commentary podcast.
It's always bad. I'm
He's
sorry.
Counting lawn signs and bumper stickers.
I'm sorry. This is like saying this is the crowd size thing. Right. Like Romney's going to win because he had a big rally in Pennsylvania.
Tell me. Don't give me.
Sorry about that.
Poor subject.
We were just.
I will say.
That.
By the way, the conversation we're having around about New York right now is the same conversation I had with our friend Mike Murphy, who lives in L.A., about what's happening in the L.A. mayoral's race.
Where
Rick Caruso, he thinks, is within a couple points of beating Karen Bass. Now, Caruso's running as a Democrat, but everyone knows he's a Republican because they have the nonpartisan election there. So he and Karen Bass, who's the longtime Democratic congresswoman, were the top two finishers. And he's a longtime Republican who switched his registration. He's running on this issue. He's running on the city is a mess and crime is a problem. And there's, drugs and syringes and a homeless situation that's gotten out of control. And, I don't know if he'll win, but it's going to be really close. Oregon, the gubernatorial race, I think the Republicans are going to win that race.
Right.
And it's a Portland story, right, which was like kind of ground zero in the craziness of 2020. And also in California, by the way, people aren't paying attention to this race, not the top of the ballot, down ballot. There's a race it's a CFO. It's the controller's race, which is a big statewide office. No Republican has held the statewide office in California since Jurassic times. And Lan He Chen, who parenthetically I worked with on the Romney campaign, was the policy director for the Romney campaign. He's at the Hoover Institute. He's running like a really competitive campaign for this statewide position. He's been endorsed by the LA Times. He's been endorsed by the Sacramento Bee. He's kind of a Republican, moderate Republican. I think that he's associated with Romney makes it easier for some of these, establishment organs to support him or at least not oppose him. But he's running hard on these law and order breakdown in civility issues. So I think this New York dynamic you're describing exists all over in pockets of deep blue America. The question is, will Republicans win or just get really close?
Right.
That's, you know what I mean? That's that yeah. is going to be like the Murphy, you know, the New Jersey gubernatorial race where.
Right. Yeah, which went right where Cinerelli got within three and had been polling. Yeah. I think Murphy had been polling, what, plus 16?
The only reason I think this is going to be different is because Republicans were caught off guard in the Murphy situation right. nationally. I mean, the RGA was running ads, but still, whereas this one, the Republicans are paying attention. There is mass, the RGA, I mean, just think about this. The RGA is now frantically deploying money in Oregon and New York. If you would have told them 3 months ago to start coming up with a New York and Oregon strategy, they would have laughed at you. And now it's like they're in it.
What's interesting, Abe, it seems to me, is that if Portland is the reason that the Republicans win a governor's mansion they haven't had in 40 years, and if crime is the reason that a Republican wins the mayoralty in LA, which, by the way, has happened twice in the last 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, but because of crises. It was Reardon. It was a long time.
Right. Yeah, Reardon. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, Reardon is the author of the Percy Jackson series.
And Reardon was literally in the early 90s. I mean, it's been...
You know, right, but again, same sort of situation. Out of control, city out of control.
Right.
You get like a businessman manager... Yeah. And right.
No nonsense.
Some, yeah. Right. Ideological, you know, figure who is making a racial statement by being a politician. If all of this is happening, imagine that the Democratic Party had taken seriously the portents of 2020. We keep talking about this, like Abigail Spanberger on this call after the 2020 elections, yelling at her fellow Democratic Congress members saying, "You cost us South Florida. We lost these seats because of you, because you started talking about defunding the police. Stop it. Are you crazy?" And they did. They've soft pedaled a lot of that, but the cake was already baked. And the media have created an atmosphere in which the Democrats have no feel for the fact that they are on the bad side of all these issues. Like, it's like they have to wake up in the morning and say, "I have to shut off the New York Times. I have to shut off what I'm hearing in order to understand my electorate." And it's too hard.
Well, by November 2021, the Democratic politicians who were the mayors and whatnot who were talking about defund had changed their rhetoric. But what came next is you've got to try to reverse the result of the policies, and that is still what everyone has ended up living with.
Oh, they resent it.
Yeah.
Well, that's why they're trying to impeach a prosecutor in Philadelphia, right? I mean, it's because that the rhetoric changed, but the policies underlying that have not. They've just
That was another fantastic portent, right? Which was the recall of Chesa Boudin. Yes. In, you know, what was arguably the most liberal city in the United States, which is turning neocon. I mean, I don't want to overrate it, but San Francisco doesn't get better. San Francisco is going to be what it was in the 1950s, which is a rock ribbed Republican city in a decade. Like there is going to be no alternative but to turn away decisively from these policies. But look at inflation, and then we should sort of like wrap. But you know, inflation is the most important issue, right? So you have Biden framing a spending bill as the Inflation Reduction Act. So that's like, okay, we know we need to deal with inflation somehow. So we'll do something inflationary and say that it's anti-inflationary. Like, are they crazy or are they cynical?
By the way, John, no Democrat is running on the passage of that bill. Point to me at any competitive race where a Democrat now is running on it. That's what
are the Democrats says. Running on Biden's success as a president? That's the other interesting thing, is there's this whole talking point among liberals that, you know, my God, Biden, look what he's done. He's like with this 50-50 Senate, they have gotten so much done. And it's like, yeah, congratulations. you're probably going out into the wilderness, you know, you're being exiled, and this is what you want to say is we're really great. It's like this Hochul thing. Again, over the last week, there have been people saying New York is the safest place.
Oh, I can't tell you how much I resent the idea that being peddled now that you can't hand the keys to Republicans. They're crazy conspiracy theorists. All you do is try to gaslight me. All you do is invent narratives that are false, that are demonstrably false, that I know by looking out my window to be false. And you just, you dare call us master manipulators, conspiracy theorists, peddling this garbage nonsense. You reoriented the social contract around conspiracy theories for the last 2 years. And I've noticed. How dare you?
Noah, can I just ask you one final question? I think Dan too, because I think you're, are you going to pay $20 a month for your blue check?
There will be nothing lamer than being a blue check mark if you have to pay $20 for it. You might as well just tape an L to your forehead.
This is genius. I think this is this is the smartest move. This is the one way you think maybe he can save it, because yes, every blue check now is going to be like, I'm offended that I have to pay. Buying a blue check is like joining Mensa. I'm sure there are a million people on Twitter who want that blue check and are willing to pay $240 a year to get it. And right there, that's $250 million in revenue for Elon Musk.
But only one
can
time.
Summon up with us. No, it's ongoing.
It's a year. It's a yearly thing.
It's annual.
No, it's monthly.
Oh, he's going to kill it. He's going to kill this place and we'll all be free.
By the way, but forget whether or not I'm going to pay it. Yeah. I think making blue checks lame is the greatest thing you can do.
It is the greatest, but we're calling it lame because, look, I spent 2 years when I was on Twitter making jokes about how I didn't have a blue check. It was a whole, it was a routine that I sort of like an ongoing comedy routine. And then I got one, so I couldn't do it anymore. And then it became this whole thing. The whole purpose of the blue check was to secure people's accounts so that, you know, people couldn't fake them, right? So now I just think a world in which you have to pay for the blue check is it's great. It's and he's apparently going to defend it today, Elon Musk. He's going to explain his revenue system, how he intends to bolster revenue. But there are still people paying for AOL.
I'm not going to comment on Twitter. I'm not going to comment on Twitter for business reasons, but I will say, John, you've come a long way from getting your blue check mark, bailing on Twitter despite your blue check mark, and then just commenting on lawn signs. That's like the
I know. I've gone in a terrible, terrible, terrible direction.
You really have hit rock bottom.
It's bad. You know, it's really bad. I'm
imagining
sorry.
You driving like Columbia. CAL, I saw another Zeldin sign. Write it down. Write it down. That's number 12. Okay, you got your pad out?
It's the visual that kills.
The first time I went to the RNC meeting, 30 years ago, I started an abortive, my friend Dan Cass and I started a newsletter called the Republican Facts Wire. We went to cover the RNC. Interestingly enough, it was the race in which Dan's future boss, Spence Abraham, tried to become head of the RNC and Haley Barbour won. And people were complaining about what happened in 1992 with Bush. There are 140, 156, something like that, RNC members who choose who's the head of the RNC. And the amount of talk about how the Bush campaign hadn't provided them with lawn signs, that was like, people, you couldn't get away from a conversation. It was like the Ancient Mariner, you know, like would fix you and tell you how terrible the lawn sign distribution was at the Bush campaign. So maybe I have PTSD from 28 years ago in the RNC meeting in St. Louis. Could that be?
Maybe.
Spence, the best thing that ever happened to Spence, by the way, because he lost the race. And he's like, okay, well, I guess maybe I'll run for Senate.
Yeah, 2 years later, he's in the U.S. Senate, and then he's energy secretary.
So thank God he didn't win that race.
Yeah.
Although Haley Barbour did become governor of Mississippi after.
Yeah, and Haley was a good RNC chair.
Yeah. Anyway, Dan Senor, thank you so much for joining us. We will, you know, maybe we'll talk again if Herschel Walker doesn't reach the 50% threshold and see.
Or we can Trump do a combo do as we gear up for the sixth Israeli election.
Exactly. Okay. And so for Abe, Christina, Noam, John Podhoretz, keep the candle burning.
That's all for this special episode. Thanks again to the team at Commentary Magazine for this conversation. Be sure to follow Commentary. Go to commentary.org where you can subscribe to the magazine. You can also subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. It's a daily podcast from the team at Commentary. Highly recommend it. It's part of my daily bloodstream. And of course, you can follow Commentary on Twitter at Commentary. Call Me Back is produced by Alon Benatar. Until next time, I'm your host, Dan Senor.